he said. He loaded the flare pistol, and as soon as it was dark, they walked out down the beach away from the fire, and he asked the boy if he wanted to shoot it.
You shoot it, Papa. You know how to do it.
Okay. He cocked the gun and aimed it out over the bay and pulled the trigger. The flare arced up into the murk with a long whoosh and broke somewhere out over the water in a clouded light and hung there. The hot tendrils of magnesium drifted slowly down the dark, and the pale foreshore tide started in the glare and slowly faded. He looked down at the boy's upturned face.
They couldn't see it very far, could they, Papa?
Who?
Anybody.
No, not far.
If you wanted to show where you were.
You mean, like, to the good guys?
Yes, or anybody that you wanted them to know where you were.
Like who?
Well, I don't know.
Like God?
Yeah, maybe somebody like that.
In the morning, he built a fire and walked out on the beach while the boy slept. He wasn't gone long, but he felt a strange unease, and when he got back, the boy was standing on the beach, wrapped in his blankets, waiting for him. He hurried his steps. By the time he got to him, he was sitting down. "What is it?" he said. "What is it?"
"I don't feel good, Papa."
He cupped the boy's forehead in his hand. He was burning. He picked him up and carried him to the fire. "It's okay," he said. "You're gonna be okay."
"I think I'm gonna be sick."
"It's okay." He sat with him in the sand and held his forehead while he bent and vomited. He wiped the boy's mouth with his hand.
"I'm sorry,"
the boy said. "Shh, you didn't do anything wrong." He carried him up to the camp and covered him with blankets. He tried to get him to drink some water. He put more wood on the fire and knelt with his hand on his forehead. "You'll be all right," he said. He was terrified.
"Don't go away,"
the boy said. "Of course I won't go away.
Even for just a little while."
"No, I'm right here."
"Okay. Okay, Papa."
He held him all night, dozing off and waking in terror, feeling for the boy's heart. In the morning, he was no better. He tried to get him to drink some juice, but he wouldn't. He pressed his hand to his forehead, conjuring up a coolness that wouldn't come. He wiped his white mouth while he slept. "I will do what I promised," he whispered, "no matter what. I will not send you into the darkness alone." He went through the first aid kit from the boat, but there was nothing much there of use. Aspirin, bandages, and disinfectant. Some antibiotics, but they had a short shelf life. Still, that was all he had, and he helped the boy drink and put one of the capsules on his tongue. He was soaked in sweat. He'd already stripped him out of the blankets, and now he unzipped him out of his coat and then out of his clothes and moved him away from the fire. The boy looked up at him.
"I'm so cold," he said.
"I know, but you have a really high temperature, and we have to get you cooled off."
"Can I have another blanket?"
"Yes, of course."
"You won't go away?"
"No, I won't go away." He carried the boy's filthy clothes into the surf and washed them, standing shivering in the cold salt water, naked from the waist down, and sloshing them up and down and wringing them out. He spread them by the fire on sticks angled into the sand and piled on more wood, and went and sat by the boy again, smoothing his matted hair. In the evening, he opened a can of soup and set it in the coals, and he ate and watched the darkness come up. When he woke, he was lying shivering in the sand, and the fire had died almost to ash, and it was black night. He sat up wildly and reached for the boy. "Yes," he whispered. "Yes." He rekindled the fire, and he got a cloth and wet it and put it over the boy's forehead. The wintry dawn was coming, and when it was light enough to see, he went into the woods beyond the dunes and came back, dragging a great travois of dead limbs and branches, and set about breaking them up and stacking them near the fire. He crushed aspirins in a cup and dissolved them in water, and put in some sugar, and sat and lifted the boy's head and held the cup while he drank. He walked the beach, slumped and coughing. He stood looking out at the dark swells. He was staggering with fatigue. He went back and sat by the boy and refolded the cloth and wiped his face and then spread the cloth over his forehead.
"You have to stay near," he said. "You have to be quick so you can be with him. Hold him close."
The boy slept all day. He kept waking up to drink the sugar water, the boy's dry throat jerking and chugging.
"You have to drink," he said.
"Okay,"
wheezed the boy. He twisted the cup into the sand beside him and cushioned the folded blanket under his sweaty head and covered him.
"Are you cold?"
he said. But the boy was already asleep. He tried to stay awake all night, but he couldn't. He woke endlessly and sat and slapped himself, or rose to put wood on the fire. He held the boy and bent over him to hear the labored suck of air, his hand on the thin and laddered ribs. He walked out on the beach to the edge of the light and stood with his clenched fists on top of his head, and fell to his knees, sobbing in rage.
"About being sick.
I remember shooting the flare gun."
"Do you remember getting the stuff from the boat?"
He sat sipping the juice. He looked up.
"I'm not a retard," he said.
"I know."
"I had some weird dreams."
"What about?"
"I don't want to tell you."
"That's okay. I want you to brush your teeth."
"With real toothpaste?"
"Yes."
"Okay."
He checked all the food tins, but he could find nothing suspect. He threw out a few that looked pretty rusty. They sat that evening by the fire, and the boy drank hot soup. And the man turned his steaming clothes on the sticks and sat watching him until the boy became embarrassed.
"Stop watching me, Papa," he said.
"Okay."
But he didn't. In 2 days' time, they were walking the beach as far as the headland and back, trudging along in their plastic booties. They ate huge meals, and he put up a sailcloth lean-to with ropes and poles against the wind. They pruned down their stores to a manageable load for the cart, and he thought they might leave in 2 more days. Then, coming back to the camp late in the day, he saw boot prints in the sand. He stopped and stood looking down the beach.
"Oh, Christ," he said. "Oh, Christ."
"What is it, Papa?"
He pulled the pistol from his belt.
"Come on," he said. "Hurry."
The tarp was gone. Their blankets, the water bottle, and their campsite store of food. The sailcloth had been pulled down and was blown up into the dunes. Their shoes were gone. He ran up through the swale of sea oats where he'd left the cart, but the cart was gone. Everything.
"You stupid ass," he said. "You stupid ass."
The boy was standing there wide-eyed.
"What happened, Papa?"
"They took everything. Come on."
The boy looked up. He was beginning to cry.
"Stay with me," the man said. "Stay right with me."
He could see the tracks of the cart where they sloughed up through the loose sand. Boot prints. How many? He lost the track on the better ground beyond the bracken and then picked it up again. When they got to the road, he stopped the boy with his hand. The road was exposed to the wind from the sea, and it was blown free of ash, save for patches here and there.
"Don't step in the road," he said, "and stop crying. We need to get all the sand off of our feet. Here, sit down."
He untied the wrappings and shook them out and tied them back again.
I want you to help, he said. We're looking for sand. Sand in the road, even just a little bit. To see which way they went, okay?
Okay.
They set off down the blacktop in opposite directions. He'd not gone far before the boy called out,
Here it is, Papa. They went this way.
When he got there, the boy was crouched over the road.
Right here, he said.
It was a half teaspoon of beach sand, tilted from somewhere in the understructure of the grocery cart. The man stood and looked out down the road.
Good work, he said. Let's go.
They set off at a jog trot, a pace he thought he'd be able to keep up, but he couldn't. He had to stop, leaning over and coughing. He looked up at the boy, wheezing.
We'll have to walk, he said. If they hear us, they'll hide by the side of the road. Come on.
How many are there, Papa?
I don't know. Maybe just one.
Are we going to kill them?
I don't know.
They went on. It was already late in the day, and it was another hour and deep into the long dusk before they overtook the thief, bent over the loaded cart, trundling down the road before them. When he looked back and saw them, he tried to run with the cart, but it was useless, and finally he stopped and stood behind the cart, holding a butcher knife. When he saw the pistol, he stepped back, but he didn't drop the knife.
Get away from the cart, the man said.
He looked at them. He looked at the boy. He was an outcast from one of the communes, and the fingers of his right hand had been cut away. He tried to hide it behind him, a sort of fleshy spatula. The cart was piled high. He'd taken everything.
Get away from the cart and put down the knife.
He looked around, as if there might be help somewhere. Scrawny, sullen, bearded, filthy. His old plastic coat held together with tape. The pistol was a double action, but the man cocked it anyway. Two loud clicks. Otherwise, only their breathing in the silence of the salt moorland. They could smell him in his stinking rags.
If you don't put down the knife and get away from the cart, the man said, I'm gonna blow your brains out.
The thief looked at the child, and what he saw was very sobering to him. He laid the knife on top of the blankets and backed away and stood.
Back. More.
He stepped back again.
Papa,
the boy said,
be quiet.
He kept his eyes on the thief.
God damn you, he said.
Papa, please don't kill the man.
The thief's eyes swung wildly. The boy was crying.
Hey, come on, man. I done what you said. Listen to the boy.
Take your clothes off.
What?
Take them off. Every goddamn stitch.
Hey, come on. Don't do this.
I'll kill you where you stand.
Don't do this, man.
I won't tell you again.
All right. All right. Just take it easy.
He stripped slowly and piled his vile rags in the road.
The shoes.
Come on, man.
The shoes.
The thief looked at the boy. The boy had turned away and put his hands over his ears.
Okay, he said. Okay.
He sat naked in the road and began to unlace the rotting pieces of leather laced to his feet. Then he stood up, holding them in one hand.
Put them in the cart.
He stepped forward and placed the shoes on top of the blankets and stepped back. Standing there, raw and naked, filthy, starving. Covering himself with his hand, he was already shivering.
Put the clothes in.
He bent and scooped up the rags in his arms and piled them on top of the shoes. He stood there holding himself.
Don't do this, man.
You didn't mind doing it to us.
I'm begging you. Papa,
the boy said,
come on. Listen to the kid.
You tried to kill us.
I'm starving, man.
You'd have done the same.
You took everything. Come on, man. I'll die. I'm gonna leave you the way you left us. Come on. I'm begging you.
He pulled the cart back and put the pistol on top, and then turned and set off along the road south, the boy crying at his side, leaving the nude and slat-like creature standing there in the road, shivering and hugging himself. The boy looked back.
Oh, Papa,
he sobbed.
Stop it.
I can't stop it.
What do you think would have happened to us if we hadn't caught him? Just stop it.
I'm trying.
When they got to the curve in the road, the man was still standing there. There was no place for him to go. The boy kept looking back, and when he could no longer see him, he stopped, and then he just sat in the road sobbing. The man stopped and dug their shoes out of the cart and sat down and began to take the wrappings off the boy's feet.
You have to stop crying, he said.
I can't.
He put on their shoes and then stood and walked back up the road, but he couldn't see the thief. He came back and stood over the boy.
He's gone, he said. Come on.
He's not gone,
the boy said. He looked up, his face streaked with soot.
He's not.
What do you want to do?
Just help him, Papa. Just help him.
The man looked back up the road.
He was just hungry, Papa. He's going to die.
He's going to die anyway.
He's so scared, Papa.
The man squatted and looked at him.
I'm scared, he said. Do you understand? I'm scared.
The boy didn't answer. He just sat there with his head bowed, sobbing.
You're not the one who has to worry about everything.
The boy said something, but he couldn't understand him.
What?
He said. He looked up, his wet and grimy face.
Yes, I am, he said. I am the one.
They wheeled the tottering cart back up the road to where they'd left him, and stood there in the cold and the gathering dark, and called, but no one came.
He's afraid to answer, Papa.
Is this where we stopped?
I don't know, I think so.
They went up the road, calling out in the empty dusk, their voices lost over the darkening shorelands. They stopped and stood with their hands cupped to their mouths, hallooing mindlessly into the waste. Finally, he piled the man's shoes and clothes in the road. He put a rock on top of them.
We have to go, he said. We have to go.
They made a dry camp with no fire. He sorted out cans for their supper and warmed them over the gas burner, and they ate, and the boy said nothing. The man tried to see his face in the blue light from the burner.
I wasn't going to kill him, he said,
but the boy didn't answer. They rolled themselves in the blankets and lay there in the dark. He thought he could hear the sea, but perhaps it was just the wind. He could tell by his breathing that the boy was awake, and after a while the boy said,
But we did kill him.
In the morning they ate and set out. The cart was so loaded it was hard to push, and one of the wheels was giving out. The road bent its way along the coast, dead sheaves of salt grass overhanging the pavement, the lead-colored sea shifting in the distance, the silence. He woke in the night with the dull carbon light of the crossing moon beyond the murk, making the shapes of the trees almost visible, and he turned away, coughing. Smell of rain out there. The boy was awake.
You have to talk to me, he said.
I'm trying.
I'm sorry I woke you.
It's okay.
He got up and walked out to the road, the black shape of it running from dark to dark. Then a distant low rumble, not thunder. You could feel it under your feet, a sound without cognate, and so without description. Something imponderable shifting out there in the dark. The earth itself contracting with the cold. It didn't come again. What time of year? What age the child? He walked out into the road and stood. The silence. The saliter drying from the earth. The mud-stained shapes of flooded cities burned to the waterline. At a crossroads, a ground set with dolmen stones, where the spoken bones of oracles lay moldering. No sound but the wind. What will you say? A living man spoke these lines. He sharpened a quill with his small penknife to scribe these things in slow or lamp black. At some reckonable and entabled moment, he is coming to steal my eyes, to seal my mouth with dirt. He went through the cans again, one by one, holding them in his hand and squeezing them like a man checking for ripeness at a fruit stand. He sorted out two he thought questionable, and packed away the rest, and packed the cart, and they set out upon the road again. In 3 days they came to a small port town, and they hid the cart in a garage behind a house and piled old boxes over it, and then sat in the house to see if anyone would come. No one did. He looked through the cabinets, but there was nothing there. He needed vitamin D for the boy, or he was going to get rickets. He stood at the sink and looked down at the driveway, light the color of wash water congealing in the dirty panes of glass. The boy sat slumped at the table with his head in his arms. They walked through the town and down to the docks. They saw no one. He had the pistol in the pocket of his coat, and he carried the flare gun in his hand. They walked out on the pier, the rough boards dark with tar and fastened down with spikes to the timbers underneath. Wooden bollards. Faint smell of salt and creosote coming in off the bay. On the far shore, a row of warehouses in the shape of a tanker, red with rust. A tall gantry crane against the sullen sky. "There's no one here," he said. The boy didn't answer. They wheeled the cart through the back streets and across the railroad tracks and came back into the main road at the far edge of the town. As they passed the last of the sad wooden buildings, something whistled past his head and clattered off the street and broke up against the side of the block wall building on the other side. He grabbed the boy and fell on top of him and grabbed the cart to pull it to them. It tipped and fell over, spilling the tarp and blankets into the street. In an upper window of the house, he could see a man drawing a bow on them, and he pushed the boy's head down and tried to cover him with his body. He heard the dull thwang of the bowstring and felt a sharp, hot pain in his leg. "Oh, you bastard," he said. "You bastard!" He clawed the blankets to one side and lunged and grabbed the flare gun and raised up and cocked it and rested his arm on the side of the cart. The boy was clinging to him. When the man stepped back into the frame of the window to draw the bow again, he fired. The flare went rocketing up toward the window in a long white arc, and then they could hear the man screaming. He grabbed the boy and pushed him down and dragged the blankets over the top of him. "Don't move," he said. "Don't move and don't look." He pulled the blankets out into the street, looking for the case for the flare pistol. It finally slid out of the cart, and he snatched it up and opened it and took out the shells and reloaded the pistol and breached it shut and put the rest of the loads in his pocket. "Stay just like you are," he whispered. He patted the boy through the blankets and rose and ran limping across the street. He entered the house through the back door with the flare gun leveled at his waist. He could smell the cold septic odor of the burning magnesium. The house was stripped out to the wall studs. He stepped through into the living room and stood at the stair landing. He could hear the flare hissing in the upper room. He looked out the front window to where the cart lay in the street. Then he went up the stairs. A woman was sitting in the corner holding the man. She'd taken off her coat to cover him. As soon as she saw him, she began to curse him. The flare was burning in the floor with a rushing sound, and the whole room was lit with a hard white light. The wall was already afire, and the magnesium was burning its way through the floor. He crossed the room and looked out the window. The woman's eyes followed him. Scrawny, lank gray hair. Smoke was coming out of the coat.
Who else is up here?
She didn't answer. He stepped past her and went through the rooms. His leg was bleeding badly. He could feel his trousers sticking to his skin. He went back into the front room.
Where's the bow? He said.
I don't have it.
Where is it?
I don't know.
They left you here, didn't they?
I left myself here.
He turned and went limping down the stairs. The hot magnesium had fallen through the ceiling and lay burning in a pool in the floor below. He opened the front door and went out into the street, backward, watching the house. When he got to the cart, he pulled it upright and piled their things back in.
Stay close, he whispered. Stay close.
They put up in a store building at the end of town. He wheeled the cart through and into a room at the rear, and shut the door and pushed the cart against it sideways. He dug out the burner and the tank of gas and lit it and set it in the floor, and then he unbuckled his belt and took off the blood-stained trousers. The boy watched. The arrow had cut a gash just above his knee, about 3 inches long. It was still bleeding, and his whole upper leg was discolored, and he could see that the cut was deep. Some homemade broadhead beaten out of strap iron, an old spoon, God knows what. He looked at the boy.
See if you can find the first aid kit, he said.
The boy didn't move.
Get the first aid kit, damn it! Don't just sit there.
He jumped up and went to the door and began digging under the tarp and the blankets piled in the cart. He came back with the kit and gave it to the man, and the man took it without comment and set it in the concrete floor in front of him and unsnapped the catches and opened it. He reached and turned up the burner for the light.
Bring me the water bottle, he said.
The boy brought the bottle, and the man unscrewed the lid and poured water over the wound and held it shut between his fingers while he wiped away the blood. He swabbed the wound with disinfectant and opened a plastic envelope with his teeth and took out a small hooked suture needle and a coil of silk thread and sat holding the silk to the light while he threaded it through the needle's eye. He took a clamp from the kit and caught the needle in the jaws and locked them and set about suturing the wound. He worked quickly, and he took no great pains about it. The boy was crouching in the floor. He looked at him. And he bent to the sutures again.
You don't have to watch, he said.
Is it okay?
Yeah, it's okay.
Does it hurt?
Yes, it hurts.
He ran the knot down the thread and pulled it taut and cut off the silk with the scissors from the kit and looked at the boy. The boy was looking at what he'd done.
I'm sorry I yelled at you.
He looked up. That's okay, Papa.
Let's start over.
Okay. In the morning it was raining, and a hard wind was rattling the glass at the rear of the building. He stood looking out. A steel dock half collapsed and submerged in the bay, the wheelhouses of sunken fishing boats standing out of the gray chop. Nothing moving out there. Anything that could move had long been blown away. His leg was throbbing, and he pulled away the dressing and disinfected the wound and looked at it, the flesh swollen and discolored in the truss of the black stitching. He dressed it and pulled his blood-stiffened trousers back on. They spent the day there, sitting among the boxes and crates.
You have to talk to me, he said.
I'm talking.
Are you sure?
I'm talking now.
You want me to tell you a story?
No.
Why not?
The boy looked at him and looked away.
Why not?
Those stories aren't true.
They don't have to be true. They're stories.
Yes, but in the stories, we're always helping people. And we don't help people.
Why don't you tell me a story?
I don't want to.
Okay.
I don't have any stories to tell.
You could tell me a story about yourself.
You already know all the stories about me. You were there.
You have stories inside that I don't know about.
You mean like dreams?
Like dreams. Or just things that you think about.
Yeah, but stories are supposed to be happy.
They don't have to be.
You always tell happy stories.
You don't have any happy ones?
They're more like real life.
But my stories aren't.
Your stories aren't, no.
The man watched him. Real life is pretty bad.
What do you think?
Well, I think we're still here. A lot of bad things have happened, but we're still here.
Yeah.
What? You don't think that's so great?
It's okay.
They pulled a work table up to the windows and spread out their blankets, and the boy was lying there on his stomach, looking out across the bay. The man sat with his legs stretched out. On the blanket between them were the two pistols and the box of flares. After a while, the man said,
"I think it's pretty good. It's a pretty good story. It counts for something."
"It's okay, Papa. I just want to have a little quiet time."
"What about dreams? You used to tell me dreams sometimes."
"I don't want to talk about anything."
"Okay."
"I don't have good dreams anyway. They're always about something bad happening. You said that was okay because good dreams aren't a good sign."
"Maybe. I don't know."
"When you wake up coughing, you walk out along the road or somewhere, but I can still hear you coughing."
"I'm sorry."
"One time I heard you crying."
"I know."
"So, if I shouldn't cry, you shouldn't cry either."
"Okay."
"Is your leg gonna get better?"
"Yes."
"You're not just saying that?"
"Nope."
"Because it looks really hurt."
"It's not that bad."
"The man was trying to kill us, wasn't he?"
"Yes, he was."
"Did you kill him?"
"No."
"Is that the truth?"
"Yes."
"Okay."
"Is that all right?"
"Yes."
"I thought you didn't want to talk."
"I don't."
They left 2 days later, the man limping along behind the cart and the boy keeping close to his side until they cleared the outskirts of the town. The road ran along the flat gray coast, and there were drifts of sand in the road that the winds had left there. It made for heavy going, and they had to shovel their way in places with a plank they carried in the lower rack of the cart. They sat in the lee of the dunes and studied the map. They brought the burner with them and heated water and made tea and sat wrapped in their blankets against the wind. Just down shore were the weathered timbers of an ancient ship, gray and sand-scrubbed beams, the pitted iron hardware deep lilac in color, smeltered in some bloomery in Cadiz or Bristol, and beaten out on a blackened anvil good to last 300 years against the sea. The following day they passed through the boarded ruins of a seaside resort and took the road inland through a pine wood. The long, straight black top drifted in pine needles, and the wind in the dark trees. He sat in the road at noon in the best light there would be and snipped the sutures with the scissors and put the scissors back in the kit and took out the clamp. Then he set about pulling the small black threads from his skin, pressing down with the flat of his thumb. The boy sat in the road, watching. The man fastened the clamp over the ends of the threads and pulled them out one by one, small pinlets of blood. When he was done, he put away the clamp and taped gauze over the wound and then stood and pulled his trousers up and handed the kit to the boy to put away.
"That hurt, didn't it?" the boy said.
"Yes, it did."
"Are you real brave?"
"Just medium."
"What's the bravest thing you ever did?"
He spat into the road, a bloody phlegm.
"Get up this morning," he said.
"Really?"
"No. Don't listen to me. Come on, let's go."
In the evening, the murky shape of another coastal city, the cluster of tall buildings, vaguely askew. He thought the iron armatures had softened in the heat, and then reset again to leave the buildings standing out of true. The melted window glass hung frozen down the walls like icing on a cake. They went on. In the night sometimes now, he'd wake, in the black and freezing waste, out of softly colored worlds of human love, the songs of birds, the sun. He leaned his forehead on his arms, crossed over the bar handle of the cart, and coughed. He spat a bloody drool. More and more he had to stop and rest, and the boy watched him. In some other world, the child would already have begun to vacate him from his life. But he had no life other. He knew the boy lay awake in the night and listened to hear if he were breathing. The days sloughed past, uncounted and uncalendared. Along the interstate in the distance, long lines of charred and rusting cars, the raw rims of the wheels sitting in a stiff gray sludge of melted rubber, blackened rings of wire. The incinerate corpses shrunk to the size of a child and propped on the bare springs of the seats. 10,000 dreams and sepulchred within their crozzled hearts. They went on, treading the dead world under like rats on a wheel. The nights dead still and deader black, so cold. They talked hardly at all. He coughed all the time, and the boy watched him spitting blood. Slumping along, filthy, ragged, hopeless. He'd stop and lean on the cart, and the boy would go on, and then stop and look back, and he would raise his weeping eyes and see him standing there in the road looking back at him from some unimaginable future, glowing in that waste like a tabernacle. The road crossed a dried slough where pipes of ice stood out of the frozen mud like formations in a cave. The remains of an old fire by the side of the road. Beyond that, a long concrete causeway, a dead swamp. Dead trees standing out of the gray water, trailing gray and relic hag moss. The silky spills of ash against the curbing. He stood leaning on the gritty concrete rail. Perhaps in the world's destruction, it would be possible at last to see how it was made. Oceans, mountains, the ponderous counter-spectacle of things ceasing to be, the sweeping waste, hydroptic and coldly secular, the silence. They'd begun to come upon dead windfalls of pine trees, great swaths of ruin cut through the countryside, the wreckage of buildings strewn over the landscape, and skeins of wire from the roadside poles garbled like knitting. The road was littered with debris, and it was work to get the cart through. Finally, they just sat by the side of the road and stared at what was before them. Roofs of houses, the trunks of trees, a boat, the open sky beyond where in the distance the sullen sea lagged and shifted. They sorted through the wreckage strewn along the road, and in the end he came up with a canvas bag that he could tote over his shoulder and a small suitcase for the boy. They packed their blankets and the tarp and what was left of the canned goods and set out again with their knapsacks and their bags, leaving the cart behind. Clambering through the ruins, slow going, he had to stop and rest. He sat in a roadside sofa, the cushions bloated in the damp, bent over, coughing. He pulled the blood-stained mask from his face and got up and rinsed it in the ditch and wrung it out, and then just stood there in the road, his breath pluming white. Winter was already upon them. He turned and looked at the boy, standing with his suitcase like an orphan waiting for a bus. In 2 days' time, they came to a broad tidal river where the bridge lay collapsed in the slow-moving water. They sat on the broken abutment of the road and watched the river backing upon itself and coiling over the iron trellis work. He looked across the water to the country beyond.
What are we gonna do, Papa? He said.
Well, what are we?
Said the boy. They walked out the long spit of tidal mud, where a small boat lay half buried, and stood there looking at it. It was altogether derelict. There was rain in the wind. They trudged up the beach with their baggage, looking for shelter, but they found none. He scuffled together a pile of the bone-colored wood that lay along the shore and got a fire going, and they sat in the dunes with the tarp over them and watched the cold rain coming in from the north. It fell harder, dimpling the sand. The fire steamed and the smoke swung in slow coils, and the boy curled up under the pattering tarp, and soon he was asleep. The man pulled the tarp over himself in a hood and watched the gray sea shrouded away out there in the rain, and watched the surf break and fan out along the shore and draw away again over the dark and stippled sand. The next day they headed inland again, a vast low swale where ferns and hydrangeas and wild orchids lived on in ashen effigies, which the wind hadn't yet reached. Their progress was a torture. In 2 days, when they came out upon a road, he set the bag down and sat bent over with his arms crossed at his chest and coughed till he could cough no more. 2 more days, and they may have traveled 10 miles. They crossed the river, and a short ways on, they came to a crossroads. Down country, a storm had passed over the isthmus and leveled the dead black trees from east to west like weeds in the floor of a stream. Here they camped, and when he lay down, he knew that he could go no further, and that this was the place where he would die. The boy sat watching him, his eyes welling.
"Oh, Papa," he said.
He watched him come through the grass and kneel with a cup of water he'd fetched. There was light all about him. He took the cup and drank and lay back. They had for food a single tin of peaches, but he made the boy eat it, and he wouldn't take any.
"I can't," he said. "It's all right."
"I'll save your half."
"Okay. You save it until tomorrow."
He took the cup and moved away, and when he moved, the light moved with him. He'd wanted to try and make a tent out of the tarp, but the man wouldn't let him. He said that he didn't want anything covering him. He lay watching the boy at the fire. He wanted to be able to see.
"Look around you," he said. "There is no prophet in the earth's long chronicle who's not honored here today. Whatever form you spoke of, you were right."
The boy thought he smelled wet ash on the wind. He went up the road and came dragging back a piece of plywood from the roadside trash, and he drove sticks into the ground with a rock and made of the plywood a rickety lean-to, but in the end it didn't rain. He left the flare pistol and took the revolver with him, and he scoured the countryside for anything to eat, but he came back empty-handed. The man took his hand, wheezing.
"You need to go on," he said. "I can't go with you. You need to keep going. You don't know what might be down the road. We were always lucky. You'll be lucky again, you'll see. Just go. It's all right."
"I can't."
"It's all right. This has been a long time coming. Now, it's here. Keep going south. Do everything the way we did it."
"You're gonna be okay, Papa. You have to."
"No, I'm not. Keep the gun with you. At all times. You need to find the good guys, but you can't take any chances. No chances. Do you hear?"
"I want to be with you."
You can't. Please, you can't. You have to carry the fire.
I don't know how to.
Yes, you do.
Is it real, the fire?
Yes, it is.
Where is it? I don't know where it is.
Yes, you do. It's inside you. It was always there. I can see it.
Just take me with you, please.
I can't. Please, Papa, I can't. I can't hold my son dead in my arms. I thought I could. But I can't.
You said you wouldn't ever leave me.
I know. I'm sorry. You have my whole heart. You always did. You're the best guy. You always were. If I'm not here, you can still talk to me. You can talk to me. And I'll talk to you. You'll see.
Will I hear you?
Yes, you will. You have to make it like talk that you imagine. And you'll hear me. You have to practice. Just don't give up. Okay?
Okay.
Okay.
I'm really scared, Papa.
I know. But you'll be okay. You're going to be lucky. I know you are. I've got to stop talking. I'm going to start coughing again.
It's okay, Papa. You don't have to talk. It's okay.
He went down the road as far as he dared. And then he came back. His father was still asleep. He sat with him under the plywood and watched him. He closed his eyes and talked to him, and he kept his eyes closed and listened. Then he tried again. He woke in the darkness, coughing softly. He lay listening. The boy sat by the fire, wrapped in a blanket, watching him. Drip of water. A fading light. Dreams that encroached upon the waking world. The dripping was in the cave. The light was a candle which the boy bore in a ring stick of beaten copper. The wax dripped on the stones. Tracks of unknown creatures in the mortified Lois. In that cold corridor they had reached the point of no return, which was measured from the first solely by the light they carried with them.
Do you remember that little boy, Papa?
Yes. I remember him.
Do you think that he's all right, that little boy?
Oh, yes. I think he's all right.
Do you think he was lost?
No. I don't think he was lost.
I'm scared that he was lost.
I think he's all right.
But who will find him if he's lost? Who will find the little boy?
Goodness will find the little boy. It always has. It will again.
He slept close to his father that night and held him. But when he woke in the morning, his father was cold and stiff. He sat there a long time weeping, and then he got up and walked out through the woods to the road. When he came back, he knelt beside his father and held his cold hand and said his name over and over again. He stayed 3 days, and then he walked out to the road, and he looked down the road, and he looked back the way they'd come. Someone was coming. He started to turn and go back into the woods, but he didn't. He just stood in the road and waited, the pistol in his hand. He'd piled all the blankets on his father, and he was cold and he was hungry. The man that hove into view and stood there looking at him was dressed in a gray and yellow ski parka. He carried a shotgun upside down over his shoulder on a braided leather lanyard, and he wore a nylon bandolier filled with shells for the gun. A veteran of old skirmishes, bearded, scarred across his cheek, and the bone stoven and the one eye wandering. When he spoke, his mouth worked imperfectly, and when he smiled.
"Where's the man you were with?"
"He died."
"Was that your father?"
"Yes, he was my papa."
"I'm sorry."
"I don't know what to do."
"I think you should come with me."
"Are you one of the good guys?"
The man pulled back the hood from his face. His hair was long and matted. He looked at the sky, as if there were anything there to be seen. He looked at the boy.
"Yeah," he said, "I'm one of the good guys." "Why don't you put the pistol away?"
"I'm not supposed to let anyone take the pistol, no matter what."
"I don't want your pistol. I just don't want you pointing it at me."
"Okay."
"Where's your stuff?"
"We don't have much stuff."
"Have you got a sleeping bag?"
"No."
"Well, what have you got? Some blankets?"
"My papa's wrapped in them."
"Show me."
The boy didn't move. The man watched him. He squatted on one knee and swung the shotgun up from under his arm and stood it in the road and leaned on the forestock. The shotgun shells and the loops of the bandolier were hand-loaded and the ends sealed with candle wax. He smelled of wood smoke.
"Look," he said, "you got two choices here. There was some discussion about whether to even come after you at all. You can stay here with your papa and die, or you can go with me. If you stay, you need to keep out of the road. I don't know how you made it this far, but you should go with me. You'll be all right."
"How do I know you're one of the good guys?"
"You don't. You'll have to take a shot."
"Are you carrying the fire?"
"Am I what?"
"Carrying the fire."
"You're kind of weirded out, aren't you?"
"No."
"Just a little."
"Yeah."
"That's okay."
"So are you?"
"What, carrying the fire?"
"Yes."
"Yeah, we are."
"Do you have any kids?"
"We do."
"Do you have a little boy?"
"We have a little boy and we have a little girl."
"How old is he?"
"He's about your age, maybe a little older."
"And you didn't eat them?"
"No."
"You don't eat people?"
"No, we don't eat people."
"And I can go with you?"
"Yes, you can."
"Okay, then."
"Okay."
They went into the woods and the man squatted and looked at the gray and wasted figure under the tilted sheet of plywood.
"Are these all the blankets you have?"
"Yes."
"Is that your suitcase?"
"Yes."
He stood. He looked at the boy.
"Why don't you go back out to the road and wait for me? I'll bring everything."
"What about my papa?"
"What about him?"
"We can't just leave him here."
"Yes, we can."
"I don't want people to see him."
"There's no one to see him."
"Will you cover him up with one of the blankets?"
"Yes, I will." "Go on now."
"Okay."
He waited in the road, and when the man came out of the woods, he was carrying the suitcase, and he had the blankets over his shoulder. He sorted through them and handed one to the boy.
"Here," he said, "wrap this around you. You're cold."
The boy tried to hand him the pistol, but he wouldn't take it.
"You hold on to that," he said.
"Okay."
"You know how to shoot it?"
"Yes."
"Okay."
"What about my papa?"
"There's nothing else to be done."
"I think I want to say goodbye to him."
"Will you be all right?"
"Yes."
"Well, go ahead. I'll wait for you."
He walked back into the woods and knelt beside his father. He was wrapped in a blanket, as the man had promised, and the boy didn't uncover him, but he sat beside him, and he was crying, and he couldn't stop. He cried for a long time.
"I'll talk to you every day," he whispered, "and I won't forget, no matter what."
Then he rose and turned and walked back out to the road. The woman, when she saw him, put her arms around him and held him.
"Oh," she said, "I am so glad to see you."
She would talk to him sometimes about God. He tried to talk to God, but the best thing was to talk to his father. And he did talk to him, and he didn't forget. The woman said that was all right. "The breath of God," she said, "is his breath yet, though it pass from man to man through all of time." Once there were brook trout in the streams in the mountains. You could see them standing in the amber current where the white edges of their fins wimpled softly in the flow. They smelled of moss in your hand, polished and muscular and torsional. On their backs were vermiculate patterns that were maps of the world in its becoming, maps and mazes of a thing which could not be put back, not be made right again. In the deep glens where they lived, all things were older than man, and they hummed of mystery.
The End. You've been listening to The Road by Cormac McCarthy, narrated by Tom Stack Schulte, and directed by Lynn Flanagan.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.